Let's get started. Those of you out in the foyer, come on in. Got a great panel to kick things off this morning. Welcome to the 2023 Federalist Society National Student Symposium in Austin, Texas, University of Texas. It's really great for me to be here and to host this panel. Believe it or not, I don't look that old, but in 1982, 40 years ago, where's Gene Myers? 40 years ago, I attended the first Federalist Society National Student Symposium at Yale University. I slept on the dorm room floor of a lawyer that's become a well-known appellate lawyer in Washington, D.C. I moderated a panel. Out in the audience was Professor Scalia, Professor Bork. A few months later, they all became judges in the federal courts, but it really was kind of an amazing experience. For those of you that went to the Lawyers Convention in November, celebrating the 40th anniversary of the society, it was fun to meet just the few of us that were at that first Federalist Society event. Well, this morning, we're going to kick things off talking about the law of democracy, and we have a superb panel to do that. And we're going to survey a lot of the process issues and the relationship between judicial review, electoral politics, legislative primacy, and those sorts of things over the next hour and 45 minutes. But if you haven't been paying attention over the past two decades, few legal issues have attracted as much popular attention as those arising out of the law of elections. In 2000, Bush versus Gore thrust the Supreme Court into the middle of a recount dispute that would decide a presidential election. In 2010, Citizens United versus FEC reshaped the boundaries of corporate speech in elections. Just 3 years later, the Supreme Court set aside the Voting Rights Act's coverage formula in Shelby County versus Holder. And just a few years ago, the Supreme Court held in Rucho versus Common Cause that partisan gerrymandering, though potentially incompatible with democratic principles, could not be policed by the federal courts. And that's not to mention countless other important cases, including faithless electors, out of my circuit, by the way, voter ID laws, Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, and much, much more. Interest around political and election law has picked up steam. There were only a few cases back when I started doing this in the 1990s as a practitioner, but there's been an explosion of election law, and it's become a major specialty among firms around the country, and we have some representatives of the election law bar with us this afternoon. And who can forget 2020 election? Allegations of voter fraud have animated national political conversations and fueled countless lawsuits in both state and federal courts, and we're still fighting about last year's elections. States like Florida have battled over felon disestablishment efforts. States like Wisconsin have debated the legality of mail-in ballots. In Pennsylvania, local and state officials changed ballot rules towards the end of the election. And as we speak, the Supreme Court is busy defining the contours of the so-called independent state legislature doctrine. And more about that this morning by our panelists. These topics are more than abstract concepts for law professors and judges to mull over. Instead, their resolution determines who can speak about candidates and political issues, how we speak about candidates and political issues, who will represent our interests in government, and how the average citizen will seek redress when he feels that some politicians have lost their way. And these issues will highlight the role of the federal courts in resolving these high-stakes disputes. We're fortunate to have an all-star panel of experts, each with whom possess a deep well of knowledge and experience in these topics. I'll begin by introducing the panel in the order in which they will speak, and then I'll hand it over to the panelists for about 10 to 12 to 15 minutes each. After that, I'll ask a few questions. We'll do a round table, if the panel would accommodate that, and then I'll open up to the field for questions. Our first speaker is Professor Derek Muller. He is the Ben V. Willey Professor, has the Ben V. Willey Professorship in Excellence at the University of Iowa College of Law. Before joining the faculty, Professor Muller attained his BA from Hillsdale College and his JD from the University of Notre Dame School of Law. Our second speaker is Professor Richard Pildes. He's the Sudler Family Professor of Constitutional Law, New York University School of Law. Professor Pildes was a graduate of Princeton University and attended Harvard Law School, and he just told me that he spent a year as a ski bum in Colorado, pretty close to me, so I'm quite impressed by that. That's better than the textbook. And I have used his textbook before also. Our third speaker is Audrey Perry Martin. She's a partner at the Gober Group, where she focuses on advising corporations, candidates, political action committees, political parties, and campaign donors on the nuances of political and election law. She has her BA in journalism from Brigham Young University, and she got her law degree from Georgetown University Law Center. Our final speaker is Lee Goodman. He's a partner at Wiley in Washington, D.C. He represents corporations, media entities, nonprofits, and political clients on compliance with election and political law. Mr. Goodman earned both his BA and JD from the University of Virginia. With that introduction, let's start with Professor Puller.
Great. Well, thank you so much for having me. It's humbling to present to you. I fondly remember my first Federal Society Student Symposium in 2005 at Harvard Law School, which I think about as a formative event in my legal and academic career. Hearing speakers, great speakers, talk about great ideas and the pursuit of new knowledge. And it also opened with the infamous line from then-Dean Elena Kagan, "I love the Federalist Society," she said to raucous applause. And when the applause died down, she said, "But you are not my people." Nevertheless, last night's opening panel was a terrific flashback to that conference 18 years ago. It was an outstanding discussion. In 2004, Chief Justice William Rehnquist published a book called The Centennial Crisis. It traced the history and legacy of the contested presidential election of 1876. Put briefly, several states each sent two sets of electoral votes from their state, one for the Republican candidate, the other for the Democratic candidate. And bitter election contests mark this period of Reconstruction in the South, this election one of the darkest moments. Congress could not agree on who won, so it appointed a 15-member commission to solve the problem. The commission was staffed with five Democrats, five Republicans, and five members of the Supreme Court. These justices were appointed not in a judicial role, but in this quasi-judicial, quasi-political position. The justices divided among themselves, and by a series of 8-7 votes, the commission chose to count the Republican votes over the Democratic votes. Rehnquist concludes the book by looking at the role that judges have played in these non-judicial roles, from Justice Robert Jackson serving as the prosecutor at Nuremberg to Chief Justice Earl Warren investigating the Kennedy assassination. He then reflected on the role that these five justices who had been conscripted into service had played. And Rehnquist writes, "The consequences of refusal would have been grave, if not entirely foreseeable. They may have tarnished the reputation of the court, but they may have also saved the nation from, if not widespread violence, a situation fraught with combustible uncertainty. In the view of this author, in accepting the membership on the commission, they did the right thing." Rehnquist didn't pick this topic on accident. 4 years earlier, in 2000, the Supreme Court was asked to step into the contested Florida election, the recount between George W. Bush and Al Gore, a decision that Bush won by 537 votes in the state. Rehnquist was acutely aware of the cries of illegitimacy, including questions of the legitimacy of the Supreme Court, when the judiciary stepped into the role of effectively closing off the major legal avenue for the Gore campaign, which had been pursuing in state court for some time in an effort to flip the result. This panel is supposed to consider, in part, the question of how the decision-making over these issues of election law should be divided between the courts and Democratic legislatures, as well as between the states and the federal government. So I want to offer some tentative thoughts about how we might think about the role of dividing these responsibilities and trade-offs to consider. One could imagine a grid with four quadrants, one axis labeled state versus federal government, and the other axis labeled legislature versus courts. So we have four different entities to think about: state legislature, state courts, the federal Congress, and the federal courts. Imagine if that grid is really four blocks, the kind that a child might have in a nursery, and we take those blocks and line them out from a 2x2 matrix in a line and think about a rank order. That is, what is the most important entity and what's the least important entity? And we can think, I think, about three different eras: the original Constitution's era, the contemporary doctrine, and the trajectory of the Supreme Court. First, on the original Constitution, the structure and the structures of state governments at the founding, and we think about where these responsibilities would reside. And the answers are not so contestable, I think. By far, the most important responsibilities would reside in the state legislatures. Even in federal elections, state legislatures were the default institution to regulate federal elections. The Constitution said effectively nothing about state elections except for an assurance that the state has a Republican form of government. Federal Congress might have been next. Congress could step in and provide regulations in federal elections, but really had no role in state elections. And even in federal elections, it was up to Congress to decide what rules to set up and whether to set them up in the first place. The Anti-Federalists were deeply worried that this power would be too great for the central government to have. And on the back end, Congress had real power to examine the elections, qualifications, and returns of its own members. Indeed, many state legislatures hold that role, something that looks like a judicial role. State courts were probably a step behind the legislative branches. They could issue writs, like the writ quo warranto, to oust illegitimate candidates from office or to order an election, but they were rare, and many of the things that we today label as political questions were not within their jurisdiction. And the federal courts were dead last. The original jurisdiction of the federal courts largely sounded in diversity, not federal questions, and there were very few federal questions that arose in elections. So this division of labor essentially meant the political branches would principally be responsible for election questions, and the state was the default place to resolve those questions. One can trace this pretty consistently for 150 years or so. States would innovate with election rules, absentee voting during the Civil War, the Australian ballot during the Gilded Age. They started to enfranchise black voters and women, but it took a national consensus and federal law to institutionalize those and constitutional amendments. State courts would issue some writs in elections, and the federal courts would occasionally, but not often, enforce voting rules. In the 1940s and 50s, the United States Supreme Court assiduously refused to step into the political arena. It issued decisions like Colgrove versus Green, concluding that federal courts would not enter the, quote, political thicket of remedying malapportioned districts, and Lassiter versus Northampton County Board of Elections, in which the court unanimously concluded that a literacy test for prospective voters, at least one fair in its face, passed constitutional muster. Today, it's possible to think that these priorities or this ranking has been entirely inverted. It's the result of a series of changes. In Baker versus Carr in 1962, mentioned by the inimitable Judge Jones last night, the court injected itself into the political thicket to effectively reshape the legislatures in all 50 states. Congress saw how recalcitrant Southern states were acting when it came to black citizens and it enacted the Voting Rights Act. That act and its amendments invited dramatically increased judicial scrutiny into the rules affecting both federal and state elections. Beginning in the 1960s, the Supreme Court began to subject all voting rules relating to ballot access to a different kind of balancing test, inviting the federal courts to balance the state's interest in election rules against the voters' interests. And by 2008, the court invited every rule of every type to face judicial scrutiny. No reason that in 2020, literally hundreds of challenges made their way through the court system to change the rules of elections. You can also follow the money. The major political parties spent around $5 million each year on legal expenses between 2003 and 2015. In 2016, that was about $15 million. In 2019, it was $28 million. It crossed $40 million in 2020. And in the last 2 years, the parties have earmarked around $60 to $70 million per year for legal expenses. So students, there's money to be had in this field. States admittedly retain an important role in developing the default rules of elections. Like clockwork at the beginning of a legislative term, dutiful media outlets cite the fact that thousands of election-related bills are introduced in state legislatures, but most of these have no chance of becoming law. Many of the ones that do become law tinker with aspects of the system. A few are vilified by politicians using the bully pulpit, but a few of the largest changes, I think about the top four voting proposal in Alaska, top five voting in Nevada, redistricting commissions established decades ago in California and Arizona, come from the initiative process, not the institutional legislature. And today, it's almost impossible to discuss election law without beginning with the federal courts. Think back to the 2020 election. Texas, can I say this, to pick one example, filed what I would consider a borderline frivolous lawsuit in the original jurisdiction of the United States Supreme Court against four other states, demanding those states count their ballots differently after the election. The court rightly tossed the case for lack of standing, but this decidedly press release complaint continued to give legitimacy to a narrative that is the federal courts principally responsible for the last word in elections. In 2016, many Democrats howled that a vacancy on the Supreme Court needed to be filled before the election for worries that a contested election question, potentially decisive to the outcome, would be presented to the court and would be evenly divided. In 2020, the appointment of a Supreme Court justice shortly before the election raised a different complaint, namely that this justice was appointed for the purpose of altering the outcome of the upcoming election. Indeed, a former federal judge and former general counsel of Boeing wrote an op-ed lamenting that it would be a due process violation for that justice to fail to recuse herself in election cases. But that brings me to the third way of thinking about these cases, and here I'm nearing the end of my time. Bush versus Gore set a high watermark of Supreme Court involvement. But since then, one is hard-pressed to find a significant victory for plaintiffs challenging election rules under the Constitution. There's a risk of oversimplifying the history, of course, but a few cases illustrate the concept. In 2006, the court issued a short opinion in Purcell versus Gonzalez, warning the federal courts that they should disfavor late changes to election laws at the risk of creating voter confusion. The Purcell principle has been the basis, explicitly or implicitly, for myriad decisions in recent years refusing to enjoin election laws close in time to the election in the federal courts. That decision includes in 2020, when the court turned back a challenge about the timing of Wisconsin's primary election in the middle of the pandemic. In the 2008 decision in Crawford, the court rejected a challenge to Indiana's photo identification law. In 2015, it rejected a challenge to Arizona's Independent Redistricting Commission. In 2016, it considered a challenge to Texas's state legislative map that had been drawn on the basis of total population. And its decision in Evanwell versus Abbott rejected the argument that Texas needed to draw districts on some basis more closely approximating total population. In 2019, in Rucho versus Common Cause, the court concluded that partisan gerrymandering claims arising under the Constitution should not be heard in the federal courts. And it fended off a tranche of plaintiffs' challenges in 2020, including Pennsylvania courts' alteration of mail-in voting rules and Texas versus Pennsylvania mentioned earlier. These cases were brought by Democrats and Republicans. They were brought by states and civic organizations. They put their arguments in terms of state power or individual rights. They all failed. This is by no means an exhaustive list, and I excluded campaign finance, and we might talk about that a little bit later. But to return to the pandemic rules for a moment, it's worth noting that the state legislatures were not potted plants. They were amending election rules constantly in 2020. They were creating more opportunities for absentee voting and more flexibility for voters, for candidate filing deadlines, for poll workers trying to stay safe. But lawsuits were filed by those who were essentially frustrated that the political process had not gone far enough. So we expect states, both courts and legislatures, to do more work, and we simply expect the federal branches to do less. The federal courts are moving that block of responsibility back in the line. Let me conclude with this. Although I'm not sure there are good reasons for us to think about it this way, but maybe. There are some, I think, good reasons for us to think about changing our original conception from the framing's parceling of responsibility. There's no question the broad enfranchisement of voters and congressional mechanisms that ensured black voters in the South could register to vote, that military and overseas personnel can get ballots in a timely fashion in a federal election. These are all good federal developments. The political branches have also increasingly abused their powers. One need only witness the frivolous objections filed by Democrats and Republicans in Congress in presidential elections in the 21st century to realize that we're a moment where political decisions may well need to be moved out of the discretionary judgment of elected leaders and deposited in the courts. The quasi-judicial functions that legislatures have held in the past are no longer taken as seriously. And while it may be lamentable, it's simply the reality. Look at Congress's bipartisan enactment of the Electoral Count Reform Act, essentially tying its hands to contest presidential elections and to defer to judicial findings. We expect courts to do more. And maybe if the Supreme Court's trend is the federal courts should do less, the state courts should do more. I have an article out for submission soon, Law Review editors take note, called Election Subversion and the Writ of Mandamus, exploring how state courts can use their extraordinary writs to ensure recalcitrant election officials do their jobs. Judge Jeff Sutton's wonderful book, Who Decides, offers a different framing of the role of state courts. The people may well entrust judges more than legislatures, and empower their judiciaries to address issues like partisan gerrymandering. Sutton writes, that doesn't alter what judges are doing, it just means that the people want the judges to do it. So to borrow from Chief Justice Rehnquist's thought, you know, perhaps the consequences of the courts refusing to take this responsibility would be more grave than if they had, or than if they failed to take it in the first place. Thank you.
Thank you, Professor Mueller. Professor Pildes.
Let me start by thanking you very much for inviting me here, and I want to particularly thank the students who have to deal with all the logistical issues. So Jonathan, Ladd, wherever you are out there, I really appreciate all of your help. But I particularly want to thank you because yesterday I was in Champaign, Illinois, giving a talk at the University of Illinois. There was 4, 5, 6 inches of snow, I don't know how much. I spent 4 hours in the airport trying to get here. And it's like entering a different world to be in 82 degrees and sun. I actually also want to thank Derek or acknowledge Derek. I think this is the first time we've been on a platform together since Congress passed the Electoral Count Reform Act as the very, very last act of the prior session of Congress in the lame duck session. Derek and I worked together with a handful of other academic experts on election law in assisting Congress in putting together the Electoral Count Act, Electoral Count Reform Act. And I mention that because, especially for all of you as students, we understood this would take a bipartisan effort, both in Congress and among academic experts, to have the credibility to work with Congress. One of the things lawyers can do in this very polarized political world in which we now exist is actually be one of those sources of efforts to kind of navigate difficult issues, including in the election context, and you know, work together to try to frame kind of acceptable, stable structures for our political process. And I have to say, working on the act and seeing it getting passed is one of the more gratifying experiences of my professional life. And since Derek is younger, I assume that's going to be true for him as well. So I wanted to mention that. I'm going to talk to you about the most important election case before the Supreme Court this term, the Moore versus Harper case on the what's called the independent state legislature theory. Judge Michael Luttig, who Derek alluded to but not by name in his comments, former general counsel of Boeing, has called it the single most important case on American democracy and for American democracy in the nation's history. Now, I think that's a tad hyperbolic, but I don't know if that's like borderline frivolous. I joked about this, Gene Meyer knows, at another event. I said, I'm not sure you can be a tad hyperbolic. I don't know if you can be borderline frivolous. But in any event, the stakes are very, very significant in the case, even if that's a little bit exaggerated. So for those of you who don't know the issue yet, let me just begin with a brief description. This is very much in line with what Derek was describing. The Constitution gives the state legislatures the power to regulate national elections for the House, the Senate, and for the presidency. The first two under the Elections Clause of the Constitution, as it's called. The presidential election is under the Electors Clause of the Constitution. For the House and the Senate, Congress does have the power to take over this role, but it has rarely done so. There are a handful of federal statutes that apply to federal elections. Under the Elections Clause power, the Help America Vote Act, the National Voter Registration Act, the Voting Rights Act, to the extent it rests in part on the Elections Clause power, though it's mainly a 14th and 15th Amendment power. But for the most part, even for our most national elections, the states set the rules. So we have this sort of unusually hyper-decentralized system for regulating the most important national offices in the land, including the presidency. Now, the Constitution in these provisions specifically assigns this power to the legislatures. That's the term in the Constitution. And so the argument of the petitioners in Moore is that this means no other sources of state law, including the state constitution, no other state actors can interfere with the power of the state legislature when it's regulating national elections. So the claim is the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, gives state legislatures a kind of unique power that they don't normally have when they're exercising ordinary legislative powers that makes them independent of other sources of law and constrains the role of other state actors. With respect now specifically to the role of state constitutions in regulating or potentially constraining state legislatures when they exercise these powers, there's a sort of a broad version of the independent state legislature theory, and there's a more narrow one. The broad version is that state constitutions are simply off the table when it comes to constraining, regulating, the exercise of the legislature's power to regulate national elections. The advantage of the broad view is it's a clear rule. state constitutions simply can't play any role in constraining state legislatures when they regulate national elections. The disadvantages of this broad, clear, bright-line rule is it would be incredibly destabilizing of the way the election process has been structured and organized throughout American history. State constitutions establish many of the rules of the election process. They involve provisions on the structure of primary elections, for example, who can participate in primary elections. They can involve this very structure of primary elections, such as whether, as in California, we use a top two primary to choose the nominees to go on to the general election. What voters in Alaska have adopted recently, the top four primary structure, as Derek mentioned, voters in Nevada have approved now a top five primary structure for their elections, which they have to approve a second time before it takes effect. Rules for redistricting, as insofar as they apply to congressional elections, including provisions in a number of state constitutions that now actually ban partisan gerrymandering, as in Florida, New York, Ohio. Rules about absentee voting, the circumstances under which absentee voting is permissible, and on and on and on. And that's just in state constitutions because, as Derek also mentioned, voters, through initiated legislation, have also taken on the role of regulating the election process in a variety of ways over a number of years in states that permit voters through direct democracy to do so. And again, voters are not the legislature, so all of those rules would also presumably be off the table under this broad version of the independent state legislature theory. Now, I should also say there's no evidence. Of course, this issue has gotten a tremendous amount of attention now. And in all that attention, there's no evidence that's really been brought forward of an original public understanding that these provisions were designed to take state constitutions out of the picture when it comes to state legislatures regulating national elections. I think the very first sign we have of anybody offering such a theory is just a story in the 1828 Massachusetts state constitutional convention. Then we don't see any further glimpses of this theory till the Civil War period. And in fact, early state constitutions did regulate the election process to some extent, such as deciding whether voting would be by viva voce, out loud, or not. In any event, there's no sign from the argument in the Supreme Court, at least as I read that argument, that there's a majority of the court that seems likely to endorse this broad version. I saw almost no support for that in the argument. Maybe somebody didn't speak too much to the issue, but I don't see the court, I don't see any real possibility that the court's going to endorse that position. Now, the narrower version of this theory with respect to state constitutions is something like the following. State courts can enforce specific provisions that are in state constitutions. So if a state constitution bans partisan gerrymandering explicitly, or a state constitution says this is the way primary elections will be structured, all of that is fine. What becomes problematic under this narrower version is state constitutional provisions that are sort of broad, fairly general, and that are then applied by state courts to constrain state laws regulating national elections. And the particular case from North Carolina is an example that would kind of test this narrower theory, because what happened in North Carolina is the state constitution has provisions guaranteeing free elections and various, you know, typical First Amendment rights of assembly and the like, but doesn't say anything directly about partisan gerrymandering. The North Carolina courts had not struck any districting down, state or federal, as an unconstitutional partisan gerrymander until this recent case, which then triggered the petition to the Supreme Court. So that's the narrower kind of version, and I think if there is a majority in the court for this doctrine, it would be some version like that. Now, the problems with that version is that they're exactly the sort of flip side of not having the bright line rule, which is this is going to be an incredibly indeterminate doctrine in the midst of an arena in which we need very clear rules established in advance. So think about some of the implications of such a doctrine if the court were to endorse it. How specific does a state constitutional provision have to be on the okay side of the line to be enforced rather than on the too general or too broad side of the line? Many state constitutions, for example, have provisions, unlike the federal constitution, that protect the right to vote. So is a right to vote provision specific enough to be enforceable under this theory, this version of the theory, or is it too broad and too general to be enforceable? Second, does it matter if state courts have developed a body of precedent around these provisions? So many constitutional provisions are written in, you know, fairly broad and general terms. They take on more determinate content over time through the course of adjudication and case resolution. Would that make a difference? So if a provision is fairly general, but there's some body of precedent in the states applying it, does it now become specific enough to not run afoul of this doctrine, this narrow version of an independent state legislature doctrine? Would that mean that the same provision in one state, which does have a body of precedent around it, can be enforced, but the exact same provision in a state that has not yet developed a body of precedent on free and fair elections, for example, would not be enforceable? And in a sense, when you think about it, the narrow version of this doctrine is very close to replicating the never-ending debate about what is the difference between legitimate judicial interpretation of a constitution and judicial decision making that kind of moves more into an area we might call policy making. It sort of constitutionalizes that basic debate because that's sort of the idea behind the intuition for those who might have it, there's something different about state courts enforcing general provisions versus more specific provisions. I should also note that if you try to apply this doctrine to the US Supreme Court decisions in the law of democracy, it's not clear how those decisions would fare. So most of the decisions in this area under the US Constitution involve fairly evulsive changes in doctrine, whether it's as Derek mentioned, you know, the development of the one person, one vote doctrine, whether it's the development of the right to vote doctrine as kind of a fundamental right under the US Constitution, which happened in the mid-1960s, arguably cases constitutionalizing the rights of political parties under the First Amendment right of freedom of association. I mean, all of the doctrines in this area, as Derek was saying, virtually all of them had no traction before the mid-1960s when the court embarked on this path. I was on a panel, Federalist Society panel a number of years ago with Judge Barrett when she was on the Seventh Circuit, and it was a panel on originalism. And I sort of raised the question, how do originalists take the whole body of law, which I've called in our casebook the law of democracy, how do they come to terms with it? And actually, there's not been that much direct engagement with this, but my view is, as a body of law, I'm not sure there's any body of law that is more non-originalist than the law of democracy. So the court was taking broad general provisions in the US Constitution, the Equal Protection Clause, sometimes the First Amendment, and applying them in these ways that hadn't been applied before. If there are concerns, and I think we do have reasons to be concerned about this, you know, if there are concerns about state courts or other state actors sort of manipulating election law, you know, in the guise of interpreting and applying it, and, you know, possibly for partisan advantage-seeking reasons, depending on the actors who might be involved, you know, I think that is a concern. But we do have constitutional doctrine that addresses that concern already. It's not from cases in the U.S. Supreme Court, but in the courts of appeals. And those courts have developed due process doctrines to protect what they call the fundamental integrity or the fundamental fairness of the election process. And the way that due process doctrine works, which, by the way, wouldn't apply only to federal elections, as the independent state legislature theory would, it would apply to state elections as well, is that if there's a well-established pattern of how state law applies to certain issues in the election process, like whether certain absentee ballots marked in one way or another are counted or not counted, if you see state actors changing that practice in the guise of purporting, to interpret election law, that can violate what the courts have called the fundamental fairness of the election process or due process. I think that that is a better route for dealing with this kind of concern, which, as I say, I think is something the system should be concerned about. But in any event, there is a question now about whether we will actually get an answer from the Supreme Court in this case, because the North Carolina Supreme Court has decided to rehear a part of this case. The Supreme Court just recently issued an order asking the parties to brief the significance of that rehearing. My view, and I think it's a widely shared view among election law experts, is that it would be far better for the court to decide this case than not to. I am hoping the court does not run away from the issue, and there is an instinct often to, especially in the Supreme Court, which thinks deciding 70 cases a year is as much as it can bear these days. When I clerked, it was 170-some cases a year they decided. But in any event, there is an instinct to kind of, find reasons to dismiss cases or get rid of them. I really hope the court resists that instinct here, because this issue is not going to go away. It's going to roil the 2024 elections when it comes to federal elections for House, state, the presidency. Any dispute over the application, the interpretation of state law in these federal elections, including any uses of the state constitution, are inevitably going to trigger this two-level dispute. What is the meaning of state law? Is this interpretation a violation of the independent state legislature doctrine? It's far better for the court itself and for the election system to decide the issue now rather than in the midst of an intense election dispute in 2024, let alone in the midst of the presidential election, where it will become much more clear whose ox is going to be gored, which party or candidate is going to benefit. It's not good for the court. It's not good for the election system to have to wait to get clarity about this, given that the issue won't go away. So I am hoping the court will go forward and actually reach the merits. And that's a view, as I say, widely shared among election experts, including many who think, the doctrine would be a very bad innovation in constitutional law, but it's still important to get it resolved. Thanks.
Hey, thank you. Both of those comments remind me of in the post-Bush versus Gore era, both when they were on the U.S. Supreme Court, Justice Scalia and Justice O'Connor came to Denver for various events, and they answered the question the same way. Someone would invariably ask, what was the Supreme Court doing interfering in the 2000 election? And both of them said, who do you want to decide who the next president is, the United States Supreme Court or the Florida Supreme Court? That issue's been around for a long time. Our next speaker, Ms. Martin, you want to go ahead?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am so happy to be here today to talk about one of my favorite topics, how elections influence democracy and vice versa. And I did want to give a shout out because this is, you guys are all students. This is a good area of law practice right now. It's booming. So if this is something you're interested in, definitely look into it. as a law firm that's always looking for people. So our previous speakers have given us a great overview of the issues involved. I want to kind of take a different approach and focus in on state legislatures specifically. So COVID and the 2020 election combined caused this big shift in state election laws, and we're still seeing that go on and the fallout from that. These changes are having unintended consequences that are rippling through the system. Some of these bills were passed very quickly without a lot of thought to how they're going to influence the election system in a state at large. And elections, they don't happen in a vacuum, and small changes can really lead to unexpected outcomes. So there's been, as we all know, an extremely heightened level of rhetoric surrounding election processes and procedures Not everything's going to destroy democracy. Not every election is the most important election of our lifetime, I promise. And the hyped-up rhetoric between election access and election integrity is such a gross simplification of the issues that it's sowing doubt in the electorate about the legitimacy of our institutions. Issues of voting hours, mail ballot signatures, voter ID, military voting, access for disabled voters, these didn't used to be partisan or controversial even after the 2000 election when this type of stuff started to ramp up after Bush v. Gore. It still wasn't as partisan. We had the Baker Carr Commission that came together and came up with all these guidelines and recommendations. Congress was able to pass HAVA to help, you know, streamline state elections. But the way we are right now, I don't think any of those things could have happened. Any law that changes the voting process isn't automatically voter suppression, and any law that gives more access to voting isn't automatically election fraud, and you wouldn't know that reading the news. And to be honest, we could game this out all day, right? Which party does an increase in early voting help? Which candidate benefits if the polls close at 8 p.m. instead of 7 p.m.? Who do restrictive mail laws hurt? The truth is, it depends. It depends on the state, it depends on the election, it depends on all kinds of different things. And no one really knows how it's gonna turn out. But what is moving the needle for political parties and interest groups and energizing their bases and raising them a ridiculous amount of money is this hyped up battle between voter suppression and election fraud. And the incentives right now are really skewed for making these issues hyperpartisan, and that's become a problem. There's always gonna be this tension between making voting more accessible and making sure elections are able to be run smoothly and securely. It's trading off risks, the risks of fraud versus the risks of some people not being able to vote. And states need to have the flexibility to enact reasonable common sense regulations designed to provide order and legitimacy to the electoral process. I've been watching the current state legislative session really closely the past few months, and it seems like the opposite is happening, right? Red states and blue states are drifting farther and farther apart in how they administer elections. Election procedure bills are being introduced at an incredible pace. Some of them are haphazardly written and seemingly without really looking at the state's election system as the whole. They have these national groups coming in and telling them, you should do this, you should do that, and they don't really think through how that's gonna affect their election system in their state. Specifically, I wanna highlight some of the issues regarding mail voting, legal issues. Mail ballots are great, they make it convenient to vote, but COVID forced states to immediately implement much more mail balloting than has ever happened before. And there wasn't time to sufficiently really study and address the problems and complexities that mail ballots present. They're slower. One of the problems we see is that mail ballots take a long time to process. If you use more mail ballots, it's gonna take you longer to get election results. It's a complicated multi-step process. I've spent countless hours in elections offices watching them count ballots. I like to compare it to watching paint dry. It's that exciting. It's complex. Most people, including some judges and legislators, don't understand how the process really works, and so their decisions don't always reflect the reality on the ground. Talking to election administrators, I think, is extremely important, talking to the people who are on the ground. Whenever anyone comes to me worried about voter fraud, which happens all the time right now, I tell them, go watch them count mail ballots in an election office. Ask a lot of questions. Ask them the processes and the procedures and the checks that they have in place to make sure all the ballots are getting counted and they're getting counted securely, and only one person, each person only gets one vote, right? So what do we do to address this? I think prioritizing transparency in elections is one way. Legislate consistent, legitimate audits of the entire election process, from the voter registration and voter registration rolls to ballot cure methods when the ballots arrive. Making sure observers are able to watch so the conspiracy theories don't crop up, and maybe live streaming the counting process. There's lots of ways we can increase transparency, and state legislatures can increase transparency in the election process. It's really had a spotlight on it in the past few years, and it's not gonna go back in a black box. People wanna know, they wanna be sure their votes are being counted, they wanna be sure there's no fraud going on, they wanna be sure everybody is getting the opportunity to vote who's eligible to vote. Mail ballots also have different security requirements. It's possible to make mail voting very secure, but it's also possible to make it too easy to cheat. And if it seems easy to commit election fraud, even if nobody is actually committing election fraud, that's going to undermine confidence in elections, right? So states that mail every voter a ballot, I think, are particularly problematic, not necessarily because that's a bad thing, but because they have to make sure their laws in other ways will account for the fact that some people are going to get multiple ballots, and sometimes ballots are going to go to the wrong place. So, for example, in California, where I'm from, everyone's mailed a ballot. Ballot harvesting is legal, meaning ballots are gathered up in baskets in community centers, political campaign headquarters, and there's a couple problems with that. First, California's voter rolls are notoriously out of date. They're terrible. And they never remove people. Their database is a famous mess. I talked to an 80-year-old man last election day in November who was really stressed out because he had gotten 4 ballots in the mail, all for the same election, all addressed to him, and he didn't know which one to vote. And he wanted to make sure his vote counted, but he didn't want to turn in the wrong ballot, right? And, you know, what do you tell him? And on election day, it's kind of hard to solve that problem. It's already, you know, too late to really solve it. The second problem was illustrated in the 2021 recall election in California. So several counties in California, and other states do this too, they have a little hole punch in their ballot envelope. And the reason why they do that is legitimate. They want to be able to have a huge stack of ballots and look up, put them in the light, and make sure there's no ballots still. They want to see all the way through to make sure they're not missing any ballots. So there's a good reason for that. But unfortunately, quite a few counties in California, on the recall, you vote yes or no to recall the governor, right? And so it's one vote, and you could see when you put the ballot in the envelope which way they voted, whether they checked the yes or no box. And with ballot harvesting, that really concerned people because they thought, well, what if a political operative gathers all these ballots from people, harvests all these ballots, and then goes through them and throws away the ones they don't like? Obviously, that's illegal. Obviously, that shouldn't happen. But our election system should be structured in that those types of things can't happen, and those types of things aren't easy to happen, so that voters have confidence that the election's being run properly. So I'd argue that California's laws have gone too far on the side of access. There's so many options for voting that people legitimately get concerned about doing it the right way. But it's certainly possible to go too far in the other direction, right? Making mail ballot laws too restrictive. I was recently asked to review a state legislative bill, and I won't say which state, but they wanted to require voters to put their driver's license number or social security number on the mail ballot envelope, like in an inner envelope type thing, which some states are doing. But the problem with this state is that they already have a notary requirement. So people already have to get their ballot notarized. It's also hard to get a mail ballot. You have to be out of state, right? Or somewhere not in your precinct. And so adding a notary where you already have to show your ID and then also writing your ID, it was a little overkill, right? It was making it too hard to vote. So going the other direction can certainly happen, and you know that needs to be avoided too. So mail ballots bring on this whole host of issues that the state legislatures really need to dive in and talk about. Signature checking is more of an art than a science. We have to store all these ballots and store them securely. They have to be cured or duplicated. I've been in an elections office and watched them iron ballots out, mail ballots out, because they were all crumpled. They've got coffee stains on them, so you have to make a duplicate so the machine can read it. And this influx of mail ballots in states that have never done it before is really causing a lot of administrative and procedural issues in these states. One of the more interesting legal cases, I think, and it was mentioned a little bit before, was the ballot receipt deadline extension in Pennsylvania. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruled that mail-in ballots received within 3 days of Election Day would be counted and presumed to have been timely mailed, but that's not at all what the statute said, right? And so this just brings up the independent state legislature theory. The Supreme Court didn't hear that case, but I think if they punt on more, they're going to need to bring a case. The Supreme Court's going to need to accept a case, like maybe like this one or another independent state legislature theory case, because that issue is going to have to be resolved, and how the state courts deal with it and how state legislatures deal with it is going to that needs to be known before we're going into the presidential election. Whether that's going to happen or not, I'm not sure. So these issues with mail ballots don't have to be partisan. Allowing ballots to be processed early, that's checking signatures, opening envelopes, not necessarily counting them, helps the results come in sooner. It reduces the time strain on election mission administrators. If you want elections in a timely manner, make ballots arrive by election day, and be really clear about that, and be really clear about the ballot cure rules instead of what we had in 2020, which was just a fiasco because nobody knew what the rules were and they were changing constantly because different entities were interpreting them at very close to the election. But unfortunately, in this political environment, it doesn't seem like there's going to be a lot of consensus in how states should be doing these things, and red and blue states are going to be moving further and farther apart. But we do need to, there needs to be some sort of guidance on who's making these decisions, because that's certainly going to be an issue in the next election. I wanted to touch briefly on early voting as well. Although early voting does make administration more complicated, it's not under the same time pressure cooker as mail bots. And sometimes it actually is helpful because when problems with early voting lead to litigation, it can be resolved before election day when most voters are voting and there's still time to fix the problems. And as somebody who works a lot with states and on election day and political parties, that's really important because if somebody calls in on election day and they don't know what to do and something went wrong, there's really not much you can do. There's very little time to solve the problem. So we're going to see an explosion of election litigation leading up to the 2024 election. 2020 was unique for many years, and you know, for many reasons, mostly because of COVID, and maybe you know, using COVID as an excuse to pass all these laws, depending on how you look at it. But election legislation and litigation don't appear to be fading. I wanted to touch really briefly on the top two, or top four, or top five voting systems that are coming along in all these states that are getting passed. Washington State and California have top two. Alaska's got this top four system. Nevada is in the process of trying to pass a top five system. These voting systems get rid of party primaries completely in favor of a jungle primary where only the top two candidates advance. And in 2008, the Supreme Court didn't strike down the Washington system. But it was a facial challenge to the law, and it turned on the fact that the system hadn't yet been implemented, and speculation about how it would affect political parties wasn't sufficient reason to strike it down. In California and Washington, we've had almost 15 years of the top two primary system. There's a lot of evidence that it does harm political parties, whether that's a legal issue or not, maybe, maybe not. But the way the system's played out in California, it's really had a demoralizing effect on Republicans in the state, affecting turnout. There's often no Republicans in ballots in statewide races. You get a lot of people not voting because they don't want to vote for the two Senate candidates because they're both liberal Democrats and everyone else in the state doesn't vote on that party. You get a lot of undervoting. The promises of greater turnout, more moderate candidates hasn't really materialized, and it's just it's taken away the power from the parties. Combining that with the gutting of state and local parties by McCain-Feingold, BICRA, and you have political power shifts from the parties to well-funded interest groups and wealthy individuals who are willing to make independent expenditures in elections. And they're also some of the same people who are passing these top two, top four systems. And so I believe Lee's going to talk more about that topic, so campaign finance issues, so I'll...
My son went to college in California, and about 2 years after he'd achieved his degree, and I saved his ballot for my election law class, but I received his ballot in Broomfield, Colorado, 2 years after he moved to Washington, D.C. So,
we get a lot of calls.
Yeah, California is very efficient in some respects. Yeah, Mr. Goodman.
Certainly, the hot topic of the day is election administration, ever since particularly the battles of 2000 and the exigencies of COVID. I want to shift gears a little bit because for many years, whenever we had these conferences, the entire subject was about campaign finance and the fears that Citizens United was going to ruin democracy. That is a phrase we hear quite often. When you don't like something, you know, it's going to ruin democracy. We have to save democracy from the First Amendment. The topic of the panel mentioned the word what is fair in elections, and so you can't understand the debate of campaign finance and the process that gives us candidates, that gives us campaigns, you know, that can result in $10 billion being spent to speak And that's only what's measured, because what's not measured is a lot of free speech on the internet, all of the evening news, all of the talk you hear on MSNBC, and all the talk you see on Fox. None of that's considered a measurable expenditure or contribution in elections. And so, you know, if you had to quantify the amount of political speech that people are hearing every 2 years, it's probably nearly $100 billion worth of airtime. So you really can't discuss these the issues of campaign finance without grappling with this issue of what is fair, which was the topic we were given. And indeed, over the last 100 years, certainly since the late 1800s and early 1900s in the progressive movement, there was a deep concern about the doctrine of fairness or equality in speech that gives us candidates, that gives us ideas, and that influences who gets elected and the policy outcomes. And you can't understand the modern arguments about campaign finance without understanding, you know, 100 years of debate between capitalists and labor, and the struggle between them, and the concern that capitalists had more money, therefore they would speak more, therefore they could influence the public more and or influence politicians more and win pro-business, pro-capitalist public policy. In 1974, there were major restrictions imposed on your right to spend your own money and make expenditures to speak. And one of the government's justifications for that was the equalization of speech, that it was unfair to give people, based on their wealth, greater speaking ability in the democracy. And in Buckley v. Valeo, the Supreme Court rejected the notion that equalization of speech can ever justify a restriction on the free speech of Americans, and that every American has a First Amendment right to spend their own resources to speak in the democracy. Ever since that time, what you will hear in the debates is largely about corruption, because the Supreme Court in Buckley v. Valeo and in a subsequent case, more recent, McCutcheon, the Supreme Court has emphasized that the only compelling governmental interest to restrict the ability to spend to buy speech in democracy is the prevention of corruption of politicians. I think one of the more honest books in the reform movement on this subject is a book written in 2016 by Rick Hasen, a professor in California, called Plutocrats United, where he says we need to get off trying to always fit our arguments for reform into the rubric of corruption, and we need to get on with the business of relitigating the Buckley ruling that fairness and equality are not compelling governmental interests. So we need to change the jurisprudence and stop arguing, embedding this argument, these arguments about reform against the wall of corruption. So along came a case in 2010 called Citizens United, and it said that citizens who incorporate their associations, whether in the nonprofit form or the business form, do not shed their First Amendment rights merely because they incorporate their association. And that shareholders in a business corporation, it's very easy to see, for example, in a small, closely held business, we may incorporate our association for liability purposes, but if there are five or six shareholders in a small business, it's easy to see how we are nevertheless an association of people associating around our shared economic interests. By the way, labor unions associate around a shared economic interest. And the same principle applies to a big publicly traded corporation. You own shares in a corporation, you're part of an association of people, and you don't lose your First Amendment right to speak in the democracy in favor of your interests. Well, that did give rise to a lot of hyperbole, that all of a sudden the big corporations of America were going to take over all speech in America and drown out all of the populist voices and sources of populist persuasion in the democracy. And it didn't happen. We've had a good, you know what, close to going on 13 years now, Citizens United, and the evidence just doesn't bear out that the large corporations of America have drowned out or displaced populist participation or populist voices in the democracy. In fact, big business has largely shied away from political speech. That has been a political effort, you know, particularly on the left, to push business out by boycotting, protesting, all of those things, and businesses are highly sensitive to that. But I think most of the data shows that when you look at all the sort of the super PAC spending that was spawned by Citizens United, corporate money in those organizations is a very, very less than 10% of all of that spending, and all of that spending is just a very small component of all the campaign and political party spending that you see. So what you do see is a lot of super PACs being funded by wealthy individuals on the left, you know, Tom Steyer and George Soros on the right, I don't know who's the Kochs, other people. But when they do that, they aren't exercising their rights under Citizens United. Those rights were recognized of individuals to spend their own money in Buckley v. Valeo. And there is another important case along the way called Massachusetts Citizens for Life versus FEC, where the court said nonprofit corporations can spend in elections so long as all of their donors are individuals. So Citizens United is not the cause of wealthy individuals associating to spend their wealth in elections. But even with all of that wealth, there is one report that a few wealthy individuals, probably about 100 wealthy individuals, spent about, you know, 7 or 8% of the money in politics. And again, when you compare that to all the other speech that's occurring in the democracy, I don't see how any one source of funding or speech can overwhelm all the speech we have, unless, of course, you want to take your egalitarian notion of reform and apply it to other big corporations like News Corp, like the New York Times, like the Washington Post, owned by a very wealthy individual. And we have never, ever decided that the New York Times can be limited in its speech because it has too many resources and too many printing presses, can buy too much paper, too much ink, and drown out the voices and steer the public debate away from the rest of us. And I might also note that these concerns about Citizens United were overstated in people's fear that one side would win, because the data all shows that the left and the right have been competitive in both the spending by wealthy individuals to speak and fund independent expenditures, as well as businesses. So note, each side has been amplified. So with that in mind, I did want to cover three topics of reform over the last 10, 15 years and innovation that have amplified populist voices, and that we can do more to enhance the populist voices. And first, I want to talk about political parties. Political parties are, especially at the state and local political parties, I call them the Motel Sixes of politics, because they are continuous political operations, always with a light on if some citizen wants to decide, I want to go get involved in politics. And yet, our laws have largely debilitated state and local parties from doing what they do best. And what they do best is not TV and radio advertising, although they do that. They're best at grassroots political activity. You know, they are the ones who, more than any other group, sponsor door knockings, the passing out of pamphlets, get out the vote drives, development of lists for voter contact, all of those things which are highly salutary, virtuous activities in a democracy. And yet, between the limits imposed by the Federal Election Campaign Act and additional onerous restrictions placed on state and local parties under the McCain-Feingold Law of 2002, we have largely made the state and local parties irrelevant to candidates and campaigns and debilitating their effort to do what they do best, and that is promote populist political participation. So here are some proposals for reform. Some have shown up in legislation that's pending. First, political parties are restricted in the amount they can spend in coordinated expenditures. Political party has a strict limit on how much it can coordinate with its own candidate to elect that candidate. And that was challenged in the 10th Circuit. I second chaired that argument in the mid-1990s in a case called Colorado v. FEC. And it went to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court said that Congress could make a judgment that parties may be a conduit for sort of bank shot corruption, and therefore Congress could restrict the parties and their coordinated their ability to coordinate with candidates, but that parties had the same right as all other individuals and groups to make independent expenditures. So what that's driven is the parties have had to contort all of their political activity to create these independent expenditure operations with people who are sealed off, often in a separate building somewhere. Let the parties coordinate with their own nominees. The parties are fully transparent. They report every dollar in. You can see that. You could fashion an earmarking rule if you needed to, so that people couldn't just earmark and therefore circumvent their contribution limit to the candidate. But let the parties play with their candidates to elect their candidates. Second, the current limit on anyone's ability to give to their state and local parties, and state and local parties in a state are presumed to be one unit, and they share a $10,000 per year contribution limit. That needs to be vastly increased so that state and local parties can become relevant players in the political system, and also allow local and state parties to have separate limits, because local parties are critically important to the process as well. I used to be a general counsel to the state party, the Republican Party of Virginia, and the local units would come to me and say, what can we do to help elect our candidates? And I said, well, there's not a lot unless you want to register, create a separate account, jump through all of these regulatory hoops, face audits by the Federal Election Commission if you don't report accurately. And almost universally, they would decline to participate on behalf of their federal candidates, and they weren't allowed to use the money they raised into their state funds to engage in federal elections. And finally, we need to reverse many of the restrictions imposed on state and local parties under the McCain-Feingold restrictions. What the McCain-Feingold law did was it said, all those populist get-out-the-vote activities that you engage in, you can only spend your limited federal dollars on that. You cannot spend your state account on those activities, even if your whole get out the vote drive is around state and local candidates. So long as there's a federal candidate on the ballot, you have to use exclusively 100% your limited federal dollars under these $10,000 shared limits at the federal and state level. And so that's why they've been basically debilitated out of the system and made irrelevant. The second area of populist, when we talk about fairness, of source for populist political speech is the internet. The internet's been a great leveling of the playing field for speech. Anyone who has something interesting to say for the cost of a personal computer, a little bit of software, a lot of originality and ideas can gain an audience on the internet and compete with the big boys on the internet. And there have been so many upstart online media entities who compete, who break big stories that have an influence in the election. But that wasn't necessarily going to be allowed by the federal government. I see former Commissioner and Chairman Brad Smith from the Federal Election Commission here, and he knows this case quite well. There was a man named Leo Smith in Connecticut, and Leo Smith knew how to build websites in the 1990s, one of the first people, you know, built websites and started a business around it. And he was upset with Republican Congresswoman Nancy Johnson in Connecticut because she had voted to impeach Bill Clinton. So he, using his small business resources, his computer, his software, his internet connection, he built a website encouraging the people of Connecticut to vote Nancy Johnson out of office. There were complaints about him, so he ran to the FEC to get an advisory opinion to ask the commission, is the use of my computer and my software and my internet access and any graphics that I purchase, are those inputs regulated by the FEC as an expenditure or a contribution? And the Federal Election Commission said yes. That was in 1998. So all of a sudden, anybody sitting at their dining room table on their personal computer was regulated by the federal government. And if you tried to republish, if you wanted to link, for example, to a candidate's website, that's called republication. Guess what republication is? Republication is a form of coordination. Guess what coordination means? It means it's a contribution. If you're an small incorporated entity, that's a prohibited contribution. You can go to prison for that. So the commission started getting numerous advisory opinion requests. Pandora's box of regulation had been opened. People didn't know, is a link a contribution to a candidate? If I link to their website, nobody knew how in this new virtual digital world to calculate what any of those things were worth. So the commission in the early 2000s went to work on a new regulation. Through fits and starts and a court opinion that remanded back to the commission, they landed in 2006 with a regulation called the Internet Exemption. The Internet Exemption drew a very clear line. If you pay a third party to post your material on another person's website, banner ad, whatever it might be, a Facebook ad, that is going to be regulated just like taking out an ad in the Washington Post or the New York Times. But if you post your material for free, you build your own website, you create your own blog, so long as you're posting for free and there's no expenditure to a third party, that is wholly unregulated. It's not an expenditure or a contribution. And that has allowed free speech about politics to flourish on the internet ever since. However, about 10 years ago in 2014, a division developed on the commission where more pro-regulatory commissioners decided, wait a minute, we think that the internet's kind of slipping out from our control, it's becoming very effective, we want greater control over it, and they went back to the Leo Smith paradigm and said, we think if you have internal production costs, maybe that does trigger a contribution or expenditure that can be regulated. And the commission has been largely divided on that issue for about the last 10 years. I know because I was on the commission, and I was in the freedom camp, and it was a very intense debate at the time, and it is rearing its head once again. The commission issued a supplemental notice of proposed rulemaking in December, and once again, they raised the issue of whether production costs that go into an otherwise free post on the internet, i.e. the software costs, the graphics, any intellectual property you purchase, maybe if you're a nonprofit organization and you pay a staff member to create and post something for the organization, there are still commissioners who want to regulate all of that that then gets posted for free on Facebook or Twitter or wherever it goes. And that we also see efforts in Congress now to regulate the internet in H.R. 1, S1, and the Honest Ads Act. And those proposals are to regulate issue speech and require people to disclose who they are if they just want to discuss issues on the internet. The last one, I'll just close with this, and that is, populist political giving has been catapulted into the system through the new online donation platforms. We're talking billions of dollars in small dollar donations that give everyday citizens the ability to steer their money around the country. And I think that's a wholly salutary development. It wasn't necessarily preordained. There were regulatory debates at the commission, but largely they've been freed. And so I think that that is a positive development as well. And again, it prevents the large, wealthy donors from drowning out the populist voices in the system.
Thank you, panel. That was really a great overview and survey of where we are today. I will, if you want to ask a question from the audience, go ahead and start to line up at the microphones like we did last night, and we'll entertain questions. Before we get to that, I'd like to do a quick roundtable of our panel and get some reaction or comment to what they heard. We start with Derek.
Sure, just very briefly, I want to pick up on one of Audrey's points, thinking about state legislatures right now. She's right that there are a lot of problems happening as state legislatures, and I use the word tinker with election laws, whether it's outside groups saying, oh, if you just did this one thing, it would be great, or internally saying, oh, if we just sort of meddle with this and that. Election codes are complicated, sprawling things, some of which trace some of their language back to the 19th century. Can I tell you the number of cases that I keep looking at in the state courts where some tweak at some point in time uses inconsistent language, creates ambiguities in the statute, doesn't refer to other portions of the code that are relevant? We had a case in Iowa this year where the Supreme Court had to look at a provision of law that said you shall include this information on your petitions, and then a later enacted statute that said you shall disqualify petitions that lack this information. But the list of information didn't match between the two portions of the code. And so what are you supposed to do? In Florida, they have every few years, they appear to tinker with the election code about the resign to run laws, who needs to resign before they run for office, the conditions when that happens, for no real rhyme or reason. Then the legislature is anticipating the next election and who they want or who they don't want on the ballot and modifying the rules. This is just happening throughout the United States. It's a deeply unfortunate thing, and this is not a Republican or Democratic issue, but if any of you are working in state legislatures or working with state legislators, let me encourage you to tap the brakes on some efforts, and maybe I'm channeling my undergraduate Burkean roots to say, you know, maybe adding new stuff isn't necessarily the best thing, and maybe slowing down and thinking about how things affect the whole is a really important development.
Rick?
There's so many rich issues here that'd be fun to talk about. Yeah, I'll just pick out two things real quick in response to Audrey's presentation. One of the things that happened in 2020, which was not because legislatures didn't have time to do this, is that we knew we were going to have a very large number of absentee ballots coming in, and we knew that states that didn't allow their election officials to start processing those ballots until election night we're going to inevitably delay numbers. And in our circumstances, that was going to be a source of distrust and suspicion. I wrote about this way in advance of the 2020 election. Justice Kavanaugh actually quoted me saying this. It was partisan politics, which I still don't fully understand, in states like Pennsylvania and Michigan and Wisconsin that prevented them from doing what was obviously needed to be done, which was to do what a lot of states do, like Florida and many others, to allow the process of absentees to begin before election night. The second thing I want to say, it's the only other point I'll make, on the top four, top two primaries and these reforms, one of the reasons that the movement has been now towards top four or top five primaries, as in Alaska and Nevada, which voters have adopted, is precisely because of the problem Audrey mentioned with California. With a top four primary or top five primary, it's highly likely that they're going to be candidates from both political parties or both sides of the spectrum that are going to get into the general election. There is some concern about how these primary structures affect political parties, but what motivates them is the sense that many people have of frustration that under the primary structure we have been using, voters end up with an extreme candidate from one party and an extreme candidate from the other party in the general election, and a lot of voters are kind of shut out from the meaningful choice they would like to have. The point of these structures, is to enable candidates to get to the general election who actually would have majority support in the electorate if they aren't shut out by the kind of old-fashioned primary structure that we have been using, which we become more aware is one of the sources driving the extremism in our politics. So there are some potential costs to it. No election system has all advantages and no disadvantages. But I think it's important to understand the motivation behind the efforts that to move in this direction, which are voter-approved measures, out of the sense of dissatisfaction and frustration and alienation that lots of voters feel with what's been happening in our highly toxic political culture of recent decades.
Let's go ahead and open up to the audience. I see some lines growing, so let's get some participation here. Let's start on this side.
Okay.
Please identify yourself and what school you represent.
Yes, sir. My name is Rachel Hall. I'm from Washington and Lee Law out of Lexington, Virginia. Thank you guys for coming and speaking to us. I have a question that relates to something that Professor Mueller said, but it's an open question. With the passing of the 17th Amendment, I know that Professor Mueller discussed the importance of state legislatures in legislation, in election law. Do you think that the role and the importance of state legislatures was severely denigrated by the passing of the 17th Amendment? Do you think that there's any way to restructure or for states to have more of an impact in federal legislation in light of that?
Well, on the 17th Amendment, there's super interesting history there. The states wanted to give up the responsibility in the early 20th century. They were petitioning for a constitutional convention to amend the Constitution. That's what got Congress, because the Senate wasn't really interested in passing the 17th Amendment because they all got there pre-17th Amendment, right? But the prospect of a constitutional convention really freaked them out, so then we get the 17th Amendment. There were tons of vacancies. You can read Vic Amar's literature on that. You know, the tons of vacancies that were happening because the state legislature couldn't agree, couldn't send people along. So there are costs, right? The state legislatures obviously have less of a role. It's very hard to see how we undo that. I think people think about direct election in a variety of offices as being a really important thing. There have been some efforts in some places to try to tweak and say, well, could the legislature maybe nominate a candidate it likes and then put a label on the ballot, which runs into different problems, Cook versus Gralick in 2000, for instance. So there have been some creative things around that. But when it comes to the election of senators, I think maybe this is to, you know, Lee's point, it's really on the party and whether or not the legislature sort of as sort of the leaders of the party in that state have the impetus to sort of push forward the candidates within that party structure to say these are our preferred candidates and put their resources behind it. So I would say that more of the channeling has been informally or through the party structure and apparatus rather than happening through the legislatives.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Let's take a question from over here.
So, hello, my name is Tim Spangler. I'm coming in from Temple out of Philadelphia. So I'm very well experienced with terrible elections and election process. And I want to ask about the independent legislature's theory and how that is impacted by partisan judges, because in Pennsylvania we have very, very partisan judicial elections at both that are statewide for both our mid-level appellate and our Supreme Courts, where we have the Supreme Court then vastly misinterpret both either our Constitution or our state statutes. So how do we deal with the state legislatures that are built diversely across our entire state versus a group of judges that are very heavily dominated by one party, that are run on party tickets, and how does that impact the way the Constitution was meant to divvy up the powers of our state legislatures?
Yeah, who wants to start?
Everybody's looking to me? Okay. Well, I mean, where I would start is we are the only democracy that elects judges, and I just think that's a mistake. We also elect prosecutors in a lot of states and localities. And again, we're the only country in the world that elects prosecutors. These features of our system came out of the Jacksonian era and the sort of, you know, sense of democracy in that era. And it's very hard once offices have been made elective to kind of decide, you know, maybe that's not such a good idea, let's make them appointive, like in the federal system. So I think that's sort of the starting point for the problem. By the way, I would also say one of the other things that's pathological in my view about the way we have done things is we don't have independent election administrators as in many other countries, most countries. By the way, if you're following what's going on in Mexico right now, I want to flag this. Mexico had been a one-party political monopoly for decades. They finally moved towards a genuine two-party system. A key feature in that move was the creation of an independent election commission, which has been absolutely central in Mexican democracy really becoming a democratic system. The current government of Mexico is now trying to dismantle that independent election institution. There are millions of people in the streets of Mexico demonstrating about this. It's really an incredible thing about election administration. But it goes to the other point I was making here, which is, you know, we elect secretaries of state often on partisan tickets, and they're the chief election administrator for the state. Many of the local officers are also elected. All of this is a deep part of our history and the kind of unique democratic sensibility of the United States, but I think there are certain expressions of that sensibility that are actually unhealthy for our judicial system and our election administration system. I would love to see some of that change. There is movement to try to get more independent election administration, but it's very tough in the United States to create the institutions that most democracies take for granted is central to protecting the integrity of the election process.
Andre, you probably saw some of that too in the work that you've done. What's your reaction to the question?
I definitely think that when you, the election of administrators does concern me, especially these local administrators, but I'm not sure you would have it any better if you appointed them because they'd be a political appointee and could also be partisan. So I'm not sure what the solution to that issue is. Certainly you want election administrators to be nonpartisan, and most of the ones, at least the local ones that I've worked with, are pretty good at their jobs. I mean, there's some terrible ones, but there's also a lot of ones who really just want to do their job right and make sure things go correctly. But I worry that if you had them all be political appointees, especially in highly partisan states, that could be problematic. I know in California we have that problem a lot with political appointees. We have that problem also with like poll workers in certain areas being very hostile to the other party coming in. And that's probably more of a risk in a one-party state like Utah or California. But I do like the state statutes that say you have to have election administrators or election judges or poll workers from both parties or at least two different parties in the area, because I feel like that really does help keep things above the board. And you just know, that's also why I think campaigns want to send people in to watch so that somebody is at least there to see things, because even though election fraud isn't common, it doesn't happen a lot, the temptation to do that and the how it looks is problematic if you only have one party running all the elections. And one more thing, I do just want to respond quick to what Rick said about the top two, top four, top five. I do agree that top two is more problematic than four and five, and I am interested to see how this plays out in the other states because it's so new. And I like that the states can kind of experiment with it, but I'm skeptical given how it's worked in California, but we'll see.
Well, I'm always hesitant in front of students to express a dose of pessimism about the process. And I understand that our panel's being moderated by a judge.
I guess I.
But one thing you will find, you know, as you become practitioners, is a good dose of legal realism. You know, that judges are people too, and increasingly in the election law field, judges are being asked to serve as election administrators. Every dispute is going to judges, and that's part of why the Supreme Court, as Derek mentioned, why the Supreme Court in a series of cases from Purcell to Brnovich to Rucho has been trying to get out of the game of policing these disputes, and that has driven more partisans on the right and the left to the state courts looking for a friendlier ear to get the result on election administration they want. And that is one of the wrinkles in the North Carolina case of Moore v. Harper, because there you have Supreme Court justices who are elected as partisans to the Supreme Court, And unfortunately, you know, that decision that's on appeal to the Supreme Court was a 4-3 opinion on partisan lines, breaking from 100 or more years of interpretation of the Free Elections Clause, changing the jurisprudence of the state, and it was perceived as a partisan opinion. And unfortunately, now they've just had an election in North Carolina, and the Constitution of the Supreme Court changed to a 5-2 Republican majority, and the author of the dissent in Moore v. Harper at the state court is the Chief Justice with 5 conservative judges with him on that bench, and he has granted a motion for reconsideration of the prior opinion that's on appeal for the Supreme Court. And it does beg sort of confidence in the courts, you know, to referee if they're going to be dragged into election administration, that they set up some partisan and political guardrails when they render these opinions, less people lose more and greater confidence in the courts. And I think that has animated some of Justice Roberts' concerns. At the U.S. Supreme Court, he guards the reputation of that court, and he knows that politicizing the court can only be difficult. Unfortunately, now we're seeing state courts politicized too, and that's why Moore v. Harper is very important, because it's a growth industry now in the state courts. So, sorry, but there is a dose of legal realism that we have to recognize even in the judicial system.
A great example of the upside of a lifetime appointment. Let's go over here. Here, please.
Hi, my name is Adam Bixby. I'm a 1L from Arizona State University. I actually had a question exactly about the situation regarding Moore v. Harper and it being reheard in the North Carolina Supreme Court. There was a couple of discussions about the Supreme Court of the United States possibly punting this issue, and I was wondering if the North Carolina rehearing that case is going to be their way out, if that's likely, if members of the panel could elaborate on what they think that means to the Supreme Court, since they recently asked for new briefs on the issue in light of that fact.
This is a federal courts panel now. We can, I got a lot of thoughts on 1257A, but there's a lot of complications happening right now from a variety of perspectives. So the court took this case on the Elections Clause issue in Moore versus Harper. It did not stay the decision. There were justices who dissented from that decision, so the lower court decision was still in effect. And so there's kind of a two-track that happened. One is the United States Supreme Court's hearing this Elections Clause issue, and the second is the case is sent back on the remedy to say, well, the maps are gerrymandered, what should we do? And in the Supreme Court, the petitioners said, well, listen, whatever they do on the remedy, it's not the map we want. So it doesn't really matter what happens over here, just decide this Elections Clause issue and tell us if we have the authority to draw the maps we want or not. Meanwhile, they do a remedial map, comes up before the state Supreme Court. But you're in a very unusual posture, because while this case is going on, usually there's nothing else happening in a second case. Or usually if you petition for rehearing, like, that ship has sailed, because you've got 30 days, 10 days, depends on your court, but you've petitioned for cert, the court's granted cert. Months and months have passed, right? More than a year has passed since the lower court's original decision. So now the state Supreme Court gets it on the appeal from the remedial side, and then there's an election which intervenes and changes the composition of the court in the rehearing window, and the court says, oh, now we're going to rehear it. So the United States Supreme Court is sitting there saying, well, wait a minute, do we even have jurisdiction now? Because they're rehearing this case. Now, the flip side is, does the North Carolina Supreme Court even have jurisdiction now? Because if the United States Supreme Court is hearing a federal issue, how can you revisit the same issue that's being decided at the North Carolina Supreme Court? Well, they're going to say, well, we're not deciding the Elections Clause issue, we're deciding it on state constitutional grounds. So did the United States Supreme Court only pluck one issue out and not the rest of the case? And if so, does the United States Supreme Court have to step in and say, well, now we thought we had a judgment we could review, but we no longer have it because the state stepped in? That strikes me as a really dangerous proposition to allow state courts to essentially moot cases before the United States Supreme Court. It's not mooting, but stripping jurisdiction from the United States Supreme Court by saying, oh, we're going to rehear this case, which also doesn't make any sense. And the United States Supreme Court can always step in under the All Writs Act and say, hey, no jurisdiction, don't hear this case. But doesn't really like to do that, because I think it assumed lower courts aren't going to do that. That's a very long way of saying I don't know what they're going to do, because there's there's a half dozen avenues right now in front of them that are not clear to me. If it wants to address, again, I think if they didn't want to address it, they could have dismissed the case earlier. If they wanted to moot the case, they could just sit on it. But it's really unclear to me where this goes from.
Yeah, go ahead, Rick.
Just very briefly, I think there's an opinion by Chief Justice Rehnquist that, and I don't remember the name of the case at the moment, that says that once the court has, you know, heard argument, cases have been briefed and the like, there's an independent interest in the resolution of that issue. There's a huge investment of resources, you know, in the judicial system. Not only has this case been argued, but it's you know, 4 months now after the argument, presumably drafts of the opinion, dissents, concurrences, you know, many of those things are deeply under production. And as Derek said, part of the puzzling nature of the situation right now is at the first stage of the litigation in the court, when cert was being sought, you know, some of the parties said, look, this isn't a final judgment yet because this remedial stuff is still going on in the state courts. You should wait until the remedial order is final and then the whole case is final. And then if you want to take it at that point. And that issue was briefed in the court. They didn't really ask much about it at the argument. But suddenly now, because of the rehearing petition, it's almost like it's caused them to go back to square one and ask, do we have a final judgment here? Should we actually be hearing? So it's a complete, it's really a mess at this point. And as Derek said, you know, when the court grants cert, that usually, that takes the case out of the lower courts and puts it in the Supreme Court. So whether the North Carolina court actually can do this is kind of a little puzzling and unclear. And what the Supreme Court might do about that, I don't know. But it's really, it's puzzling all of us federal courts scholars.
There's also, of course, a real politic aspect to this, whatever happens in the courts. And that's because the North Carolina legislature drew their congressional districts, remember, and those were rejected by the state court. The relief that they have sought in their motion for reconsideration to the Supreme Court is to be able to redraw the maps on a blank slate, not to revert to the maps that they drew, because they drew those maps looking at a 4-3 state Supreme Court, trying to stay on just sort of the nonpartisan, the non-gerrymander side, with a 5-2 led by the new Chief Justice who wrote the dissent below, who said North Carolina Constitution does not regulate partisan gerrymandering at all, and a Supreme Court decision in U.S. Supreme Court in Rucho saying, we're not going to police partisan gerrymandering. I think you could see as many as 3 new Republican congressional seats drawn by the North Carolina legislature before the 2024 election.
Let's take a relatively quick question over here, please.
Good morning, and thank you all for speaking with us. My name is Brady Marzen, and I'm a 1L at Georgetown Law. As to my question, there have been some efforts by President Biden and others to force disclosure of donors to 501c3s, super PACs, and that world. To what degree, in your opinion, would these more open disclosure requirements either A, increase transparency, or B, shift relative power back to state and local parties? Thank you.
Audrey, you want to start on that? And then Lee, go ahead, Lee.
Oh, well, no, I'm sorry. I didn't understand. Which disclosure laws are you talking about?
Been some efforts, I do not believe they passed, that we're trying to force disclosure of who is donating, the identities of those who donate to super PACs and some 501 nonprofits.
Okay. Well, first, all donate. I don't know what happened.
They cut your mic off.
My freedom of speech.
We didn't like that. Ronald Reagan, remember, I paid for that mic.
The FEC had a role in that, by the way. Yes. I'll tell that story another time. This was before the press exemption was well evolved. Huh. And Howard Baker filed a complaint at the FEC, and the right? FEC threatened to shut down the debate because the newspaper was paying to sponsor the debate.
And so then it became a private debate?
So Ronald Reagan picked up the cost of the debate.
Yeah.
So he was literally paying for that microphone. First off, all contributions to the political parties are already fully disclosed. All contributions to super PACs are fully disclosed. What is not necessarily disclosed, but is disclosed in certain circumstances, are donations to nonprofit organizations. And there have been some court rulings recently that have forced the FEC to expand disclosure. When you make an independent expenditure out of a nonprofit, for example, you have to disclose, you know, who gave for the purpose of funding that independent expenditure, or who gave in a certain period of time. So we've seen expansion of disclosure of donors when it's tied to a specific independent expenditure. The debate that's been raging that the Supreme Court had occasion a couple years ago in a case called Bonta was there has been a move to force greater and greater disclosure of nonprofits, and particularly in the area of issue advocacy generally, and the Supreme Court reasserted heightened judicial scrutiny and First Amendment protection for the protection of donor privacy and associational privacy, bringing current the 1958 NAACP versus Alabama case to the current jurisprudence. And so now what we're seeing is, you know, more and more litigation over protection of donor disclosure and associational privacy. But where you're making explicit campaign expenditures, generally disclosure is going to follow.
We have 30 seconds. Anybody else want to comment?
I'll just add that in general, I appreciate disclosure and disclaimers, and but California, again, has taken it to extremes. They often require duplicate disclosures of everything, like multiple entities have to disclose, and then they go back and have a nonprofit that gives to a nonprofit that gives to a nonprofit, and those donors might get disclosed. One thing they have done is for issue ads, they make you have to write the names of the top five donors on the disclaimer on the ad, which takes up half of the screen. There is some advantage to that, and I think there's some ways to figure out how to really find out who's funding maybe the independent expenditures, but again, it's a balance, and you can go too far.
Well, regrettably, the clock is hitting midnight. It's been a privilege to moderate this panel. Please join me in thanking this morning's speakers.
Thank you to our panelists and for everyone for joining us during this panel. During this 15-minute break, there's going to be a book signing out in the foyer by Professor Tessa Deitzert on her book on A Short and Happy Guide to Judicial Clerkships. And the book is selling cheaper here than it is on Amazon. So you definitely want to take advantage of that. And then please join us back in this room at 11 a.m. for our third panel. Thank you very much.